This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the death toll from a bomb explosion in central Istanbul rises to 6. The Turkish president vows to find those behind what he calls the heinous attack. Tehran says French President Emmanuel Macron's remarks following his meeting with the U.S.-based anti-Iran activist are regrettable and shameful. In the U.S., Japan and South Korea vow a strong and resolute response if Pyongyang carries out a 7th nuclear test. Thanks for joining us. A bomb explosion has hit the heart of Turkey's biggest city, Istanbul. The city's governor says at least 6 people are dead and 53 injured. The blast occurred on the busy İstiklal Street in Taksim's area, which is popular with locals and tourists. There has been no claim of responsibility as of yet. Istanbul and other Turkish cities have been targeted in the past by Kurdish separatists, Daesh, and other groups. The Turkish president says initial signs point to a terror attack. Recep Tayyip Erdogan also vowed to find those behind the quote heinous attack, stressing that those who wage terrorism against the Turkish nation will fail. Roshan Saglam is our correspondent joining us from Istanbul to tell us more about this. Well, Roshan, some time has passed by and we've, heard from the Turkish president himself talking about this. Tell us more what he said and any new developments that you may have for us.
Yes, as you said, we heard President Erdogan speaking about this explosion himself. He already had a press conference and he spoke about the explosion. He said that the number of dead people reached 6 and the number of injured is 53. He also said that the officials were able to know that a woman was the one who placed the explosive device in İstiklal Street, where the bombing took place, and he said that they were able to know the perpetrators and they will reveal information very soon. He also said that we will not allow those terrorists to reach their goals in Turkey, and we will be able to make this nation safe again. Erdogan did not speak a lot about the explosion as much as he spoke about other issues. I think this is due to the investigation still going on. However, right before Erdogan was speaking, we heard gunshots in an area that is very close to İstiklal Street. It's called Şişhane. The gunshots were heard for like a few minutes, and the police was in the area. So I think that probably this could be they could be following the suspect. Since they revealed that the suspect was a woman, I think that is most likely that those perpetrators behind what happened today is the Kurdistan Workers Party, PKK, because as we all know that Kurdistan Workers Party is known that mainly the suicide bombers, the fighters in it, half of them is females. So they're mainly women, and a lot of them have been involved in explosions or attacks that took place inside Istanbul. Also, we heard a few months ago about an attack that took place on a police station in southeastern Turkey, and 2 women were the ones attacking the police station. So most likely the perpetrators of this whole explosion will be the Kurdistan Workers Party. However, we will still wait for the official information coming from the government. As I mentioned before, the Twitter was stopped in all over Turkey. It happened again, and the internet is very slow in Istanbul particularly and all over Turkey, because the government is preventing anyone from circulating information about the explosion, and it also prevented any official from speaking about it. Only those who are allowed to speak about it now are the president, President Erdogan, as a number one speaker. The second would be Süleyman Soylu, who is the interior minister. And the third would be the Istanbul governor. Those are the only people who are allowed now to give information about the investigations, about the explosion, about the number of casualties. Those are the three people who are allowed to speak. And this particular decision came after Istanbul municipality president Akrem İmamoğlu spoke or tweeted about the explosion, and he was giving some kind of information. However, now the government had announced that no one is allowed to give information about this explosion. Also, let me here mention that Bekir Bozdağ, the justice minister, just reached the Istiklal Street where the explosion took place, and he is following the investigations closely. Also, the interior minister, Süleyman Soylu, left where he was, and he is now heading to Istanbul to also check on the explosion place and also follow the investigations. Now, this is all the information that we have up until the moment, but we are following it closely, the news, as it is very important, the most important news that's taking place in Istanbul. Also, I need to mention that about the CCTV and whether it would be easy for the government to know who placed that bag of explosives in that area. And as I mentioned, there were that this street is full of CCTVs, CCTV cameras, so it will be easy. And apparently it was easy for the officials to know who did this terrorist attack, and were able to actually, as per President Erdogan, to capture them. So we will wait for additional information about that.
Yeah, I see one shot here. Again, we can't verify this. That is a shot of a woman with a black, I guess, headgear that she's got on, wearing army pants, faded. However, her face is faded in this one particular shot that I'm looking at, as according to this particular entry or tweet, that she is the one that is responsible for this. The fact that you said that it's a woman shows that obviously they have viewed footage that indicates that obviously it's a woman. When you say that there were shots that you heard, a few minutes worth of rounds of shots is quite a long time. Do you think that there was a chase that was happening? I mean, did you listen to that yourself? Can you tell us a little bit more about that before we let you go?
Yes, actually, I've heard the gunshots. It was like for a minute and a half or maybe 2 minutes that took place. Also, let me here mention that I live nearby some military areas. So the police is in the streets where I live, because it's a very secured area. And when the gunshots happened, also the police in our street was like everywhere looking what's happening. The gunshots, as I mentioned, took 1.5 minutes or 2 minutes. And I think that this was the actual moment when the chase was happening. Now, we don't have information or official information that the capture took place at that moment, but the gunshots happening an hour or an hour and a half after the explosion took place. And later after that, few minutes after that, President Erdogan saying that we have know the suspect that was that put that bag in that area, and we know the perpetrators. So I think that this is related to what happened. So linking the two incidents together, I think that those are related. As I mentioned, if we want to speak about the area where the gunshots happened and the explosion, we want to see Taksim is here, and the explosion area is 6 minutes away from Taksim Square towards Istiklal Street. And if you walk another like 15 or 20 minutes, you are gonna reach the area where the gunshots happened. So I think that, and as I mentioned before, that Istiklal Street has other streets connecting it to other areas, which is Tophana to the Bosphorus side, and Harbiya and Tarlabashi to the side facing it. And we have Shishana at the end and Taksim at the beginning, Taksim Square at the beginning. So this suspect could have fled towards Shishana area where our office is. And this area was also closed by the police. So probably when the police would suspect someone fleeing in a kind of a way, and of course with the footage that they have, they were, I think, able to capture that suspect. So hopefully that we get more information in the coming hours. We will continue to, of course, keep you posted.
Indeed. Thank you so much. I'm sure we'll be in touch. Roshan Saglam there from Istanbul. Thank you, Roshan. Moving on, the French President Emmanuel Macron's recent meeting with anti-Iran activists is drawing a strong reaction from Tehran. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the meeting was a flagrant violation of France's international responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and violence. He dismissed Macron's praise for an anti-Iran activist as regrettable and shameful. Kanani said it's surprising that the president of a country which advocates freedom would degrade himself by meeting a dissident who has tried to spread hatred and carry out violent and terrorist acts both inside in Iran and against Iran's diplomatic missions abroad. Macron on Friday met with four notorious anti-Iran women activists, among them Masih Ali Najad, who has for years led an anti-Iran campaign from the U.S. Earlier we were joined by activist and political analyst Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi, who said the French president's recent meeting with anti-Iran campaigners is part of the maximum pressure drive against Iran.
And the recent, I mean, stand in meeting with Masih Ali Najad, the notorious, it was mentioned, activists against the Iranian nation, is something strange and new. We should not forget that Masih Ali Najad's campaign during all years was to bring violence in the Iranian streets. And she followed that campaign even during last couple of months in a very intense way to encourage more people for violence in the streets. She was the one who encouraged by his social media platforms. He brought those who were openly calling for violence, openly calling for attacking the Iranian security forces. As you know, it resulted in tens of, Iranian security forces being killed during the riots that took place. Of course, some civilians also lost their lives, but the number of the, security forces that were, killed during the recent unrest and riots inside Iran was something really shocking if you compare it to any other part of the world. So her stance against Iran, against Iranian people, against Iranian nation is really clear. And of course, the stand of the, French, president inviting her, hosting her, and meeting her is not strange, because if we look back to the, hostile policies of, unfortunately, France against the Iranian people, we find, completely understandable what they are doing. They are trying to make use of their, maximum pressure campaign on Iran in all fields and all, platforms to push Iran, of course, back from its, policies, of course, its regional policies as well.
Iran continues with legal action against those involved in recent riots, with the judiciary charging more than 750 people in three provinces. The cases were filed in the southern province of Hormozgan, as well as the central provinces of Markazi and Isfahan. Those detained face charges including incitement to killing, harming security forces, spreading propaganda against the government, and damaging public property. They will be tried in the presence of their lawyers. More than 2,000 people have already been charged, nearly half of them in the capital, Tehran. Protests erupted in several Iranian cities in September after a young woman collapsed at a police station and died in the hospital days later. The protests were initially peaceful but soon turned into riots and vandalism. Iran has blamed provocation from abroad for the violence. In a recent resolution, the UN General Assembly refused to recognize the Taliban interim government while discussing the situation in Afghanistan. However, as a correspondent reports, not recognizing the Taliban could adversely affect the nation.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country. But on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The U.S. president says that his country, Japan, and South Korea have never been more aligned in their stance against North Korea and its missile tests.
Japan and the Republic of Korea are both critical allies of the United States, and for years our countries have been engaged in a trilateral cooperation out of a shared concern for the nuclear and missile threats of North Korea poses to our people. And North Korea continues provocation for provocative behavior. This partnership is even more important than it's ever been.
Biden, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, and the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol issued a joint statement condemning the recent missile test by North Korea. The trio met on the sidelines of an East Asian summit in the Cambodian capital. The three leaders vowed a, quote, strong and resolute response in case of a seventh nuclear test. Over the past week, North Korea has fired a barrage of missiles in response to Washington and Seoul, carrying out the largest ever air drills on the peninsula. Pyongyang considers the military exercises as a rehearsal for an invasion. The U.S. and South Korea, however, say that they are holding the drills in response to the North's possible plan to resume nuclear tests. Russia's foreign minister says U.S. and NATO are militarizing Southeast Asia to contain the interests of Russia and China in the Asia-Pacific. Sergei Lavrov says the Western states are trying to master the Southeast Asian region. According to the Russian minister, Washington's Indo-Pacific strategy is meant to bypass structures for regional cooperation. Lavrov was speaking after attending the summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. He will also head the Russian delegation at the upcoming summit of the G20 countries in Bali, Indonesia. U.S. President Joe Biden earlier told ASEAN leaders that Washington is committed to building an Indo-Pacific that is free and open. Moscow and Beijing, however, view the U.S. presence in the region as a threat. And that is for World News. Do stay with us.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
A new analysis shows that there were more fossil fuel lobbyists attending the climate talks in Egypt than representatives of the 10 nations most affected by the crisis. This issue has raised concerns about the ineffectiveness of these talks. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truth Out wrote, the COP27 talks in Egypt was billed as an opportunity for countries to showcase unity against the existential threat of climate change, but an analysis released recently shows there are more fossil fuel lobbyists attending the conference than representatives of the 10 nations most affected by the crisis, heightening concerns that industry influence will water down any agreements reached at the event. A data analysis of the United Nations provisional attendance list for the closely watched conference shows that 636 fossil fuel lobbyists have been registered at the talks, up 25% from last year's COP26 conference in Glasgow. According to Corporate Accountability, Corporate Europe Observatory, and Global Witness, the groups that conducted the analysis, there are more fossil fuel lobbyists registered at COP27 than any single national delegation. While officials from the conference's host country of Egypt have characterized the talks as African COP, pledging to center the developing world in negotiations over climate solutions, fossil fuel lobbyists outnumber any national delegation from Africa, where oil and gas giants are aggressively pursuing new fossil fuel development, even as climate-driven extreme weather ravages the continent. Additionally, the new analysis shows there are more fossil fuel lobbyists at COP27 than officials from Puerto Rico, Myanmar, Haiti, the Philippines, Mozambique, the Bahamas, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Thailand, and Nepal, which the German Watch Global Climate Risk Index deems the 10 countries most impacted by the worsening global climate emergency. With time running out to avert climate disaster, major talks like COP27 absolutely must advance concrete action to stop the toxic practices of the fossil fuel industry that is causing more damage to the climate than any other industry, said a spokesperson for the three watchdog organizations, adding, the extraordinary presence of this industry's lobbyists at these talks is therefore a twisted joke at the expense of both people and planet. A list published by Corporate Accountability, Corporate Europe Observatory, and Global Witness shows that corporations and trade groups attending COP27 include the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a powerful lobbying organization that has been dubbed the Chamber of Carbon, as well as Exxon, Chevron, and other major oil and gas firms. The U.S.-based public relations firm that the Egyptian government hired to run communications for COP27 has close ties to the fossil fuel industry with a client list that includes Exxon. The outsized presence of the industry, most responsible for the climate crisis, has outraged climate campaigners who are vocally protesting polluters' influence on the COP27 talks as they continue to produce woefully insufficient action plans. The climate crisis is upon us, yet world governments continue to protect the interests of a few greedy corporations instead of the people who are most affected, said Kick Polluters Out campaign, which is holding a protest on the ground in Sharm el-Sheikh. Nowhere is that more clear than at the COP27, where big polluters like fossil fuel lobbies have once again converged to greenwash their polluting image and block the climate action we so desperately need, he said. Corporate Accountability, Corporate Europe Observatory and Global Witness noted that, unlike fossil fuel lobbyists, activists from the Global South and others harmed disproportionately by the climate crisis have effectively been shut out of the talks by high cost visa challenges and repressive actions by the hosting country. Rather than being the start of the real climate action needed, COP27 looks set to be a festival of fossil fuels and their polluting friends, buoyed by recent bumper profits, spokesperson for the coalition said, adding, "The tobacco lobbyists wouldn't be welcome at health conferences. Arms dealers can't promote their trade at peace conventions." The spokesperson added, "Those perpetuating the world's fossil fuel addiction should not be allowed through the doors of a climate conference. It's time governments got out of the pockets of polluters, come to their senses, and help make COP27 the success the world vitally needs it to be." Meanwhile, Common Dreams Road campaigners pushed back recently after U.S. President Joe Biden touted his administration's bold agenda to tackle the climate emergency during a speech at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Egypt. Addressing COP27 attendees at Tonino Lamborghini International Convention Center Sharm el-Sheikh, Biden asserted that his administration is meeting the climate crisis with urgency and determination in service of a cleaner, healthier, and safer planet for us all. As Common Dreams reported earlier, green groups welcomed Biden's announcement of stronger regulations meant to curb methane pollution resulting from oil and gas production. However, activists stressed that the president must do substantially more to combat the planetary emergency. If President Biden is serious that the U.S. is doing its part to avert climate hell, he would deliver a plan to end the era of fossil fuels, Greenpeace USA Chief Program Officer Tefer Geber said in a statement. The Biden administration has failed to deliver on their commitment to phase out oil and gas lease sales on public lands and water, and instead continues to sacrifice the health and safety of frontline communities. The commitments made today are a band-aid on damage that threatens our collective future. Earth Justice President Abigail Dillon said, "We applaud the Biden administration's commitment to clean energy investments. The Biden administration must act to catalyze climate solutions and aggressively rein in fossil pollution. The roadmap to emission reduction is clear. We must end fossil fuel extraction and exports, ensure frontline communities, which already bear the brunt of toxic pollution and extreme weather, are prioritized for investments, and strengthen and protect our bedrock environmental laws that will be crucial to building clean energy future." Rachel Kleitas, Policy Director and Lead Economist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, asserted that Biden's COP27 speech comes at a time when the urgency of climate crisis is clear, but so is the significant shortfall in actions to address it globally, especially from richer countries like the United States. The opportunity is there for the U.S. to finally live up to its responsibilities on the global stage, and the time is now, Kleitas said, adding that with the latest science showing that the global emissions trajectory is far off track, and with devastating and costly climate impacts already taking a harsh toll on people in the U.S. and around the world, the U.S. must take bolder action to cut its emissions together with other major emitting nations and increase investment in climate resilience.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Ya Mawlaya, fakayfa yabqa fil adhab, wa huwa yarju ma salafa min hilmik, am kayfa tu'limuhu an-nar, wa huwa ya'mulu fadlaka wa rahmatak. كيف يحرقه لهيبها وأنت تسمع صوته وترى مكانه أم كيف يشتمل عليه زفيرها وأنت تعلم ضعفه
Dear listeners, you already know we were discussing this part of the Kumail supplication. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, يا مولاي فكيف يبقى في العذاب وهو يرجو ما سلف من حلمك My protector, how should he remain in the chastisement while he has hope for your previous clemency? أم كيف تؤلمه النار وهو يأمل فضلك ورحمتك How should the fire cause him pain while he expects your bounty and mercy? أم كيف يحرقه لهيبها وأنت تسمع صوته وترى مكانه How should its flames burn him while you hear his voice and see his place? أم كيف يشتمل عليه زفيرها وأنت تعلم ضعفه? How should its groaning encompass him while you know his weakness? أم كيف يتقلقل بين أطباقها وأنت تعلم صدقه? Or how should he be convulsed among its levels while you know his sincerity? Regarding this part, we started with the explanation of the vast ocean of mercy of Almighty Allah, and one of its wonders of His mercy is that He grants great blessings for few acts of the servants just because they have accompanied supplication with action and amal. We said that there are some norms and sunan operating in this life of ours that the Almighty Allah has set them in. And supplication is not negating these norms. These norms tell us that we have to accompany supplication with amal. We have to employ those natural means, and we do rely on them but it is an extension to the interaction with Allah. This is also implying the meaning of relying on Him. It is not relying on someone else. When it is an extension to His will, it is an extension to His interaction, it is relying on Him alone. In fact, this is the essence of monotheism and tawheed, toward which the Holy Quran invites the people. The effect of natural causes is not in parallel to or independent of His existence and act of Allah. That's what we see in this part of the supplication. The supplicant is praying to Almighty Allah in all affairs. The supplicant is asking Him for everything, small or big. In this case, he is asking Him that while he is in chastisement, he is still hopeful of Him. And such is the case with our life, with mundane worldly affairs. None of our affairs in life should be an exception to this principle. We should not consider ourselves needless of Allah in any of our needs and requests. We should not rely on other than Him from among His creatures.
My Lord, then how could he remain in torment when he hopefully relies upon your past forbearance, compassion and mercy? And how can the fire cause him suffering when he hopes for your grace and mercy? And how can its roaring flames shower him when you hear his voice and see his plight?
Thank you, Allah, that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So, as we understood, we believe that seeking asylum with Allah in everything, asking Him for everything, this does not contradict our employment of the means which Allah has created for us and made subservient to Him in this world. So we pray to Allah for our health and recovery from illness, and we utilize all the things and means Almighty Allah has placed for remedy and physical well-being in the field of medicine. This is so important to the extent that we believe if one were to break this equilibrium and pray to Allah away from the norms of Allah in this universe, his prayer should not be answered. And based on the tradition, he would be like an archer who shoots without a bow. Now, this is what our supplications are replete with. This is what Islam is trying to educate us. Islam, based on this subtle and clear vision, is trying to educate us as to how to deal with Allah and His norms in the universe. This is what Imam Ali alayhi salam has taught us throughout his entire life and in his words. And with this very perspective, we find the supplications of all the infallible imams, all the a'imma, replete with beseeching Allah, and He alone should take charge of the affairs of the servants, and not to make the other servants dependent on other than Himself. We learn that the true supplicant, the true believer, should connect his cord to the cord of Almighty Allah, and cut himself off from all the things that cuts him off from the Almighty Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close, close to you through
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
More than 7 years have passed since the Saudi aggression against Yemen, and the only achievement of the aggressor from this crime is the killing and displacement of millions of innocent people in the shadow of the silence of the United Nations and human rights institutions. Both the United States and Britain have played a malicious role in thwarting peace efforts in Yemen. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television network has more for us on this story. Yemen's popular resistance movement Ansar Allah warns about the United States and Britain's fresh malicious intentions in the war-ravaged country. Referring to Yemen's biggest province, which spans from the country's center towards its eastern areas, Ali al-Qahoum, a member of Ansar Allah's political bureau, said, "There is a direct U.S. military presence in Yemen and an influx of U.S. forces, specifically in Hadhramaut province." Referring to Yemen's second largest province that neighbors Hadhramaut to the east, he added, "There is also an influx of British forces into Al-Mahra." The United States and Britain were preparing for a fresh round of escalation in Yemen, he further warned without elaborating. "The Western countries have been contributing heavily and unabatedly to a war of aggression that the Saudi Arabia-led coalition has been waging against Yemen since 2015. The coalition has been seeking unsuccessfully, though, to restore Yemen's power to the country's former Western and Riyadh-aligned officials. The war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis." Washington and London have been providing the coalition with direct arms, logistical and political support, including through outfitting it with precision-guided ammunition that the Saudi-led military forces have been using against the civilian population of Yemen. Al-Qahoum said new U.S. and British military delegations had arrived in Yemen recently. Reporting on Wednesday, 2nd of November, Yemeni media cited informed local sources as saying that Hadhramaut provincial governor Mahbud bin Mahdi had held a face-to-face meeting with the U.S. delegation in his office. However, the Ansar Allah official asserted that despite the Western states' apparent preparations for a new flare-up in Yemen, the Yemenis are ready to defend their dignity and every inch of their country. Yemen's press agency has more for us on this story. Amid Washington's aggressive attempts to wrest control over energy reserves and plunder natural resources in conflict-plagued Yemen, a new batch of U.S. military forces has entered the country's oil-rich eastern province of Hadhramaut. Citing informed local sources who asked not to be named, the agency reported that Hadhramaut provincial governor Mahbud bin Mahdi had had a face-to-face meeting with a U.S. delegation in his office. During the meeting, Mahbud bin Mahdi complained to the American military officials about the Sana'a-based National Salvation Government's decision to ban the Saudi-led coalition from exporting the Yemeni crude oil, asserting that the decision would have adverse effects on the global energy market. The development comes as visits by Western officials to eastern Yemen has lately witnessed an accelerating trend, the most recent of which was the visit of French ambassador to Aden, Jean-Marie Safa, in late September. The visits are viewed as Western effort to secure its energy needs against the backdrop of the Russian special operation in Ukraine. Back on 28th of July, a batch of U.S. military forces landed at Al-Qaeda Airport in Yemen's southeastern province of Al-Mahra on board a flight from Riyadh International Airport in Mukalla, which lies on the shores of the Arabian Sea and about 480 kilometers east of Aden. The Yemen press agency reported at the time that the arrival of the U.S. forces was followed by a major disruption to internet connectivity in the Seyhout district, blaming the internet blackout on the installation of sophisticated surveillance devices by American military forces. Earlier, a top-ranking Yemeni official said U.S. and British military trainers had arrived at a port in Mahra province on vessels loaded with munitions as well as military and logistical equipment. The provincial governor, Al-Qatabi Ali Hussein Al-Faraj, said on 26th of June that large arms shipments about military vessels disembarked at the port of Nishtun and that British and American military trainers were stationed at Al-Qaeda International Airport. Faraj said at the time, the Saudi-led coalition of aggression is involved in the smuggling and trade of narcotics in the area in order to perpetuate insecurity, to advance its goals, and deter the local population from confronting the invaders. Yemen's official Sabah news agency has more for us. The head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council has hit out at U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, for scuttling efforts to extend the United Nations brokered truce, describing the truce situation in the country as a time bomb. Mahdi al-Mashat said in Sana'a on Monday, 7th of November, "We are in a no-peace, no-war state. While we had reached a good level of understanding during previous rounds of talks, the American envoy's trip to the region thwarted these efforts." Referring to Lenderking's journey to the region starting on 11th of October to purportedly support the United Nations-led negotiations to extend truce in Yemen, al-Mashat said, "While the U.S. envoy pretends to be a peace dove, he's rather an ill-omened owl." Mahdi al-Mashat said, "Some aggressor countries which benefit from the war in Yemen are pushing the country towards a political and military explosion," citing the U.S. envoy's malicious role in the failure of the peace talks. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war in Yemen back in March of 2015 in collaboration with its Arab allies. The objective was to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abdurrahb Mansour Hadi and crushed the popular Ansarullah resistance movement of Yemen, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Sana'a. But the Saudi-led coalition has failed to meet any of its objectives. The United Nations brokered truce between the Saudi-led coalition and Yemen first came into effect back in April and has been extended twice since then. In mid-October, Yemeni Foreign Minister Hisham Sharaf said there would be no talks about the extension of the six-month truce, which expired on 2nd of October, unless the nation's legitimate demands were fully met. He stressed that the Sana'a-based National Salvation Government will make every effort to establish just and dignified peace throughout the country.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.